Good morning. We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session Thursday, November 12, 2009, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Coal River Mining, docket numbers Weaver 2006-125, 126, 127, and 128, and Weaver 2007-196. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. We will start with an overview of the case presented by John Sullivan of the Office of General Counsel. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. In these consolidated contest and civil penalty proceedings, the Commission Administrative Law Judge upheld a citation charging Coal River Mining, LLC with a significant and substantial violation of 30 CFR Section 75.340A, but concluded that the violation was not the result of the operator's unwarrantable failure. In his decision, the judge also upheld in whole or part three orders alleging other violations of regulations by Coal River. The commission subsequently granted the Secretary of Labor's petition for discretionary review, which challenges the judge's determination that the Section 75.340A violation was not unwarrantable, and the penalties the judge assessed for that citation in the three orders. This case arose out of an investigation by the Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration of an incident at Coal River's Tiny Creek No. 2 mine, an underground coal mine in Lincoln County, West Virginia. During the evening shift on Friday, January 27, 2006, batteries being charged on the ground at a battery charging station overheated, which led to the triggering of the mine's alarm system. There was a mine-wide evacuation of approximately 30 miners, and rescue teams were called, but no miners were injured. At the time of the overheating incident, Coal River was using two scoops on the section for such tasks as carrying supplies and cleaning the section. A Fairchild 35C model that the operator primarily depended upon, and another much older model. Each scoop had its own battery charging station. From the record, it appears that while the scoops may not have been both used continuously over all three shifts of the mine, they were used enough that each had two sets of batteries, but the second set of batteries for the older scoop was rarely used. The Fairchild 35C could be charged at the battery station, while its batteries remained on it, in which case the scoop would be idled. With the availability of the second set of batteries, the scoop's batteries could also be removed and placed on the ground for charging on the ground. The scoop could then go back into service by using the alternate set of batteries, which would have been previously charged on the ground while the scoop was being used elsewhere. The two battery charging stations would be set up and generally moved as mining progressed and as frequently as was called for as by conditions at the mine. In January 2006, the two battery charging stations had been set up in a location where, within a few days, deteriorating roof conditions prompted Superintendent B.K. Smith to direct third shift foreman Mark Blackburn to move the stations to an area with better roof. Moving the stations permitted supplemental roof support to be added to the area with bad roof. In testifying in the hearing in this matter, Blackburn described in details the steps that would be taken to complete the move to and set up at a new location for the battery charging station. Those steps, including applying pyrochem or some other fireproofing material on the roof and ribs. Coal River would routinely spray pyrochem on the ribs and roof around a battery charging station as a fire retardant that would provide the fireproofing required by Section 75.340A for charging batteries on the ground at such stations. Blackburn testified that the normal practice would be to spray a new battery charging station area with pyrochem before transporting the charger and batteries to the new location so as to avoid getting the chemical on that equipment. With respect to moving the battery charging station in this instance, however, the new area was not sprayed first because the deteriorating roof made removal of the battery charger, batteries, and ancillary items to the new location a priority. Blackburn moved the equipment and other items to start the process of setting up the new station and assigned section foreman Ronnie Bias and his crew the task of completing the setup. Blackburn stated that he specifically instructed Bias to spray the area with pyrochem. Coal River stored pyrochrome that it was not planning on immediately using on the surface, bringing it in a couple days prior to use so it could thaw out in the event it was frozen. In this instance, the outdoor temperatures that January had frozen the chemical, so it could not be immediately applied by the BIAS crew at the time. As a result, it was left near the battery charging station to thaw out. At the end of the shift the next morning, both Blackburn and Smith learned from BIAS that it would be impossible to immediately apply the pyrochem. According to Blackburn, Smith responded, "Okay, we'll get someone to take care of it." Smith testified that he told a foreman that the pyrochem had not been applied and expected that the foreman would pass the information along. In addition, according to Smith, BIAS informed incoming day shift section foreman Keith Pack that the pyrochem had not been applied at the new battery charging station, and that, consequently, batteries should not be charged on the ground, only on the scoop. It is undisputed that Coal River had not sprayed pyrochem by the evening of January 27. Batteries were being charged on the ground there that night, and they apparently released hydrogen gas, which triggered the mine's carbon monoxide sensors. MSHA personnel traveled to the mine that night and began their investigation 2 days later, interviewing miners and inspecting the battery charging station. As a result, MSHA issued Coal River 3 citations and 3 orders. Coal River contested the citation, charging a violation of Section 75.340A and the 3 orders. All 4 of the contested citations and orders were designated by MSHA as S&S and attributable to Coal River's unwarrantable failure under Section 104(d)(1) of the Mine Act. MSHA later proposed civil penalties of $10,300 for each 3 of the violations, and a hearing requested the penalty for the 4th also be $10,300. Because of the lack of fireproofing at the battery charging station that overheated, the contested citation charged Coal River with a violation of Section 75.340A. The judge affirmed the citation on the ground that Coal River was not using any of its 3 fire protection options at the time of the overhearing incident. He found that the battery charging station was neither equipped with a fire suppression system nor housed in a non-combustible structure, and because the pyrochem had not been applied, the area could not be considered non-combustible. The judge further found, given the condition of the battery cables, there was a likelihood of fire and that the danger of such fire would be even greater because of the failure to provide fire suppression measures. Consequently, the judge concluded that the violation was S&S. With regard to Coal River's negligence, the judge determined that because Coal River intended to apply pyrochem but was thwarted by the chemical being frozen, the operator's failure to apply it did not rise to the level of an unwarrantable failure. The judge credited the testimony of the mine superintendent as to the company's commitment to safety, found that there had been no showing that the failure to provide fire protection was a habitual practice at the mine, and concluded that the lack of pyrochem was not obvious because of the presence of rock dust on the ribs. Accordingly, the judge found the violation to be attributable to moderate negligence on the part of Coal River and ordered that the citation be so modified. The judge assessed a penalty of $2,000. The first of the other 3 orders alleged that the company violated 30 CFR Section 75.360B9 when its pre-shift examinations failed to detect the missing pyrochem. The judge affirmed the order and agreed that the violation was S&S, but held that it was not attributable to Coal River's unwarrantable failure. The judge assessed the penalty at $2,000. The next order alleged that the lack of fireproofing and the condition of the batteries established a violation of 30 CFR Section 75.512, which requires that all electric equipment to be frequently examined, tested, and properly maintained to assure safe operating conditions. The judge held that Coal River's weekly electrical examination of the batteries violated that regulation, and the violation was both S&S and unwarrantable. Judge assessed a penalty at $4,000. In the final order, MSHA asserted that the condition of the batteries that were being charged violated the requirement of 30 CFR Section 75.503 that an operator keep electric face equipment in permissible condition. The judge affirmed that Coal River violated that regulation and agreed that the violation was S&S and unwarrantable. The judge assessed the penalty at $4,000. In setting the penalties for the citation and the 3 orders, the judge particularly justified the penalty amounts on 2 factors: Coal River's low history of prior violations and abatement efforts, which the judge found to indicate greater than ordinary good faith. The secretary requests that the commission reverse the judge's negative unwarrantable failure determination, with regard to the Section 75.348 violation. Judge contends that he erred in his analysis because he focused on the conduct of the mine superintendent, when in fact three lower-level supervisors were also involved in the violation, and the judge failed to hold the four supervisors to the higher level of care the commission requires of such personnel. The secretary further contends that the non-obvious nature of the violation is irrelevant, given that supervisors were aware that the pyrochem had not been applied, and thus Coal River was in violation of the standard. The secretary also maintains that the judge erred in his analysis by failing to take the danger of the violation into account, as well as the fact that the violation existed from between several days to a couple of weeks. The secretary also requests that the commission vacate the judge's four penalty assessments and remand the case to the judge with instructions for assessing appropriate penalties for the violations. The secretary contends that the judge did not adequately explain in his decision why he diverged to the extent that he did from the secretary's proposed penalties. The secretary also argues that the judge's finding that Coal River demonstrated more than good faith in abating the violations is neither supported by substantial evidence nor permissible under the six statutory factors he was limited to considering assessing penalties. Coal River responds that the judge's conclusion that the violation was not attributable to a moral failure is supported by substantial evidence. The operator maintains that the supervisors were not aware of the violation because while they knew that the pyrochem had not been applied, they did not know that batteries were being charged on the ground at the station. Coal River also points to the lack of history of this type of violation by Coal River as supporting the judge's determination that the secretary had failed to establish reckless conduct on the part of the operator in this instance. Regarding the penalties the judge assessed, Coal River argues that they were well within the judge's discretion, given his findings on the operator's good faith and low history of violations are supported by the record evidence. The operator notes that not only did the judge reduce the level of negligence on two of the citations and orders, but for the two orders that he did conclude were unwarrantable, the judge found that the violations were not as extensive or as dangerous as the secretary originally alleged. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Chairman, you may be excused. Yeah. One of the lady, Cheryl, said she has been cut off. So if I would read that.
Yes, okay. We're going to do that. We'll wait. Okay.
Justin?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. If you could hold again, I'm going to try to reconnect someone else. Thank you.
No problem.
Hello?
Cheryl?
Hi.
Okay, thank you. Let me connect you with Justin and the rest of us.
Okay, thank you. Most of it.
Okay. Justin?
Yes.
Okay, great. Cheryl?
Just press mute and I'm on track again.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, John, for your presentation and thanks for your decisional memorandum. I found it very helpful. I believe that Commissioner Cohen can start off today.
Thank you. At the outset, I'd like to thank John Sullivan for the excellent decisional memorandum in this case. I found it thorough and thoughtful and quite convincing. I also want to thank John for meeting with me several times on Tuesday to go over points in the factual record. I'd also like to thank the chairman for allowing me to go first so that my daughter Rebecca, who is here but has to leave to catch a train, as an opportunity to hear what her father does. I think it's important to take note of the timing and significance of the incident described in this case. It took place on January 27, 2006, within weeks of both the Sago and Arakoma disasters. Indeed, the lead MSHA investigator, Fred Wills, testified that he had been at Arakoma just before this incident occurred, and the mine superintendent, B.K. Smith, spoke of the specter of Sago when he was notified of the CO sensor alarming. What happened at the Coal River mine had the potential to be every bit as horrible as Sago and Arakoma. a fire very nearly broke out because of the overheating of batteries at a charging station. If the fire had broken out, it probably would have been disastrous because of the absence of a fire suppressant system. However, the overheating batteries did not cause a fire at the Coal River Mine. There were two important reasons why a fire did not break out at the Coal River Mine. First, as Coal River's counsel noted in his opening statement at trial, MSHA, in response to Sago and Arakoma, had instructed mine operators to reduce the level of settings on their atmospheric monitoring systems so that a lower level of carbon monoxide or hydrogen would trigger the sensor and cause an alarm. Second, when the CO sensor alarmed, in this case, Coal River responded quickly and prudently to de-energize the section, evacuate 30 miners who were underground, and call in rescue teams. If the battery charger had not been promptly de-energized, a fire would have occurred. Instead, no one was injured. This is a story of a disaster which did not happen, both because of heightened, more rigorous regulation by MSHA and because of the safety-conscious response by the mine operator. This incident illustrates the continuing dangers inherent in underground mining, the enormous number of things which can go wrong in the absence of continual vigilance, and the ways that the government and mine operators working together can avoid the worst consequences of dangerous accidents. The Secretary appeals the judge's decision in citation number 7249165 to eliminate the finding of unwarrantable failure and reduce the level of negligence to moderate. This violation resulted from an unattended scoop battery charger which was not provided with a fire suppression system or enclosed in a non-combustible structure in violation of 30 CFR section 75.340A. The judge affirmed the violation and found it to be significant and substantial, but reduced the level of negligence. Our case law establishes a number of factors which are to be considered by the Commission in determining whether a violation constitutes unwarrantable failure. These factors include the operator's knowledge of the existence of the violation, the length of time the condition existed, whether the violation was obvious, whether the violation posed a high degree of danger, the extent of the violative condition, whether the operator had been placed on notice that greater efforts were necessary for compliance, and the operator's efforts to eliminate the violative condition. Our case law also establishes that while all of the factors may not be relevant in a particular case, they must all be taken into consideration. An ALJ may determine that some factors are not relevant, or that some factors are much less important than other factors under the circumstances. But the judge's decision should show that all of the factors have been examined by the ALJ on the unwarrantable failure issue. As we noted in Windsor Coal Company, Rule 69A of the Commission's procedural rules require that the ALJ must include all findings of fact and conclusions of law and the reasoning, therefore, on all material issues of fact, law, and discretion presented by the record. We cannot determine on review if the ALJ has done so unless the judge indicates findings on each of the unwarrantable failure factors, including findings that a factor is not relevant in the case. The violation of 30 CFR section 75.340A in this case resulted from the fact that after moving the battery charging station, Coal River charged scoop batteries on the mine floor without spraying the walls with pyrochem. In determining that the Secretary had not proven unwarrantable failure, the judge found that Coal River intended to apply the pyrochem, but that it was frozen. The judge stated that the mine superintendent, Mr. Smith, on finding out that the pyrochem was frozen, ordered the area to be sprayed. The judge then stated that Smith had impressed him as a caring, careful, and conscientious supervisor, that the failure to provide fire protection was not a habitual practice at the mine, and that the rock dust on the cribs made the pyrochem difficult, although not impossible, to detect. I conclude that, as in the San Juan coal case, the judge failed to consider some of the unwarrantable failure factors entirely, and that he also gave undue weight to certain of his factual findings. Essentially, the judge focused on intentions, normal practices, and the character of the mine superintendent while ignoring the specific facts of the violation and the knowledge of three other supervisors. The case should be remanded for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law on the unwarrantable failure issue. First, the judge did not fully come to grips with how it came to be that the pyrochem was not applied to the ribs and roof at SPAD 1965, and how long the condition existed before the overheating incident on the evening of January 27, 2006. It is clear that the battery charger for the Fairchild scoop was moved to its new location at SPAD 1965 because of bad top and the danger of roof falls at its previous location. Most of the move was made by the third shift mine foreman Mark Blackburn. Because of the urgency of getting the battery charger away from the bad roof, Blackburn did not spray the area with pyrochem before the move. Rather, he moved the battery charger and the other set of batteries with the scoop. Then he moved on to other duties and instructed the section foreman, Ronnie Bias, to spray the pyrochem. My reading of the record indicates that the judge was incorrect when he said that Bias was the section foreman on the incoming shift. Rather, it appears that Bias was the section foreman on the third shift with Blackburn. In any event, Bias was unable to spray the pyrochem because it was frozen. At the end of the third shift, Bias notified Blackburn and Mine Superintendent Smith that he had been unable to spray the pyrochem. According to Blackburn, Smith said that we'll get someone to take care of it. Smith, however, did not have a specific recollection. The record does not contain testimony or a deposition from Bias. However, Blackburn testified that the incoming day shift section foreman, Keith Pack, knew that the pyrochem had not been applied because Bias had told him that the battery charger and batteries had been moved, but it had not been possible to spray the area. The record is not clear as to what happened next. Pack did not testify, but his deposition was made part of the record. He testified at the deposition that the battery charging stations were located out by where he worked, and that he really knew nothing about what was going on there. With regard to the morning of January 27th, Pack said that he had taken a report before his shift and had been told that there was nothing unusual. Pack's deposition does not indicate that he had any recollection that he had been told by Bias or anyone else that there was a problem with the use of the battery charger after it had been moved to SPAD 1965. The judge did not address the issue of duration of the violation in his discussion of unwarrantable failure. However, in discussing another violation, the failure of the lack of fire suppressant to be reported in the pre-shift report, he discussed the issue of when the battery charger was moved. He noted that the testimony of MSHA Inspector Bobby Moreland that he believed the period was 2 to 3 weeks before the January 27 incident. He also noted the testimony of pre-shift examiner Jerry Vance that it was probably a week or two before January 27th. And the judge mentioned the testimony of Blackburn that the period was, quote, probably a couple of days, unquote. The judge did not mention Smith's testimony that the period was a few days to a week. Thus, at the very least, it was several days, a goodly number of shifts, between the time that the battery charger was moved and the January 27 incident at 8 p.m. This is a significant duration of time in terms of the issue of unwarrantable failure. There is also the issue of what happened during those days. Coal River argues that there is no evidence that batteries were actually charged on the ground. They could have been charged on the Fairchild scoop, which would not have been a violation in that the scoop had a built-in fire suppressant system. Thus, if batteries were charged on the scoop rather than being taken off the scoop and charged on the ground, as was clearly the case at 8 p.m. on January 27th, there would not have been a violation of Section 75.340A. It is somewhat difficult to believe that between the day shift following the movement of the battery charger and the evening of January 27th, the batteries were charged without being removed from the scoop. Coal River had two sets of batteries for the Fairchild Scoop. The whole purpose of that arrangement was so that the scoop could operate continuously with one set of batteries being charged while the other set was powering the scoop. If the scoop had been taken out of service to be charged during this period, it would have adversely affected production of coal. If that had happened, I believe that there would have been testimony from witnesses for the operator. But there was no such testimony. It reminds me of the Sherlock Holmes story, Silver Blaze, in which Holmes explained to Dr. Watson that the key to the case was the curious incident of the dog in the night. Watson, as usual, was dumbfounded and remarked to Holmes that the dog hadn't barked or done anything. Holmes said that was precisely the point. Similarly, I think that the absence of actual testimony by Coal River witnesses that production was affected by the need to change the batteries on the scoop strongly suggests that the batteries were actually charged on the ground in the usual manner, despite the absence of fire suppressant on the roof and rips. Of course, that's a matter for the judge to determine. In this context, it is significant that, as the Secretary argues, three supervisors, Smith, Blackman, and Bias, and possibly a fourth, Tack, all knew of a problem with the fire suppressant not being applied. It is not sufficient for the judge to find that they intended to apply the pyrochem, that Smith told Bias and Blackburn, quote, "we'll take care of it," and that Smith was generally a careful and conscientious mine superintendent. Clearly, when three or four supervisors are aware of the potential for a violation, it can be found that the operator has knowledge. Smith testified that he passed by SPAD 1965 in the days prior to the evening of January 27th. He said that he may not have realized the lack of pyrochem because of the presence of rock dust, but also candidly acknowledged that it was, quote, complacency on his part. It would appear that he failed to follow up on his promise to, quote, take care of it. Smith's candor is admirable and is part of the reason why the judge imposed penalties at a much lower level than had MSHA, but I don't think that candor about complacency is a mitigating factor on the issue of unwarrantable failure. Another issue that the judge did not address in the unwarrantable failure findings was the dangerousness of the violation. Elsewhere, he found that the violation was S&S and serious. This issue also needed to be addressed when discussing unwarrantable failure. Clearly, as shown by the near fire on January 27th, the charging of scoop batteries on the ground on that day without fire suppressant was a very grave danger. Hence, I believe that the judge's analysis of unwarrantable failure in the context of Section 75.340A was inadequate. The finding should be vacated by the Commission and the case remanded to the judge on this issue. The Secretary also appeals the judge's reduction of the penalties in all four cases from $10,300 each to $4,000 each in the two cases where unwarrantable failure was found, and $2,000 each in the two cases where the judge rejected our unwarrantable failure and found only moderate negligence. On this issue, I would affirm the judge, except on the Section 75.340A violation where he needs to reconsider the issue of unwarrantable failure. Presumably, if the judge finds unwarrantable failure, he will increase the penalty from $2,000 consistent with his other penalties in this group of cases. It is well established that Commission judges have broad discretion in setting penalties. However, when a penalty substantially diverges from the penalty proposed by MSHA, it is incumbent on the judge to explain why he or she diverged from the proposed penalty. The Secretary first argues that the judge did not fully explain his divergence from the proposed penalties. I disagree. The judge based the divergence on Coal River's low history of previous violations and the judge's finding of greater than ordinary good faith. We do not require our judges to write a book explaining divergences. The judge provided adequate explanation here. The Secretary also argues that the judge's focus on the operator's abatement efforts went beyond the six specified criteria in Section 110I of the Mine Act. I believe this is a poor argument. The statute specifically requires consideration of an operator's good faith. Impliedly, the statute permits a judge to assess the degree of an operator's good faith, just as he would assess the degree an operator's negligence. Lastly, the Secretary argues that the judge's finding of, quote, much more than ordinary good faith, unquote, was not supported by substantial evidence. In this regard, the Secretary argues that on three of the four violations, the operator merely did what it had to do to abate the violation and avoid further enforcement action. Although I am not really convinced of the correctness of the judge's ruling under the substantial evidence standard, I am inclined to find that substantial evidence supported the judge's finding of good faith. I reject the suggestion made by the operator that the judge based his penalty finding on his finding that the violations, and this is with regard to the third and fourth violations, were not as extensive as MSHA alleged. If the judge had actually made such a finding, I think it might have been questionable. But my reading of the judge's opinion is that he did not make that finding, that rather he based the reduction of the penalties on the low history of violations and the good faith issue. And it's, in my opinion, at least right now, unless convinced otherwise, that was legally proper and supported by substantial evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. I'd like to thank and welcome Rebecca for attending and wish you a safe trip. And you may not be able to tell, obviously, just from what you've heard, but your father's very good at what he does, and we're privileged to have him with us. And you should be very proud of him. It's easy for me to say that because I completely agree with what he said. Makes my job a lot easier. John Sullivan habitually and regularly makes my job easier and the job for all of us with his insights on these, and particularly the way he can shake out facts so that he can spotlight the ones that are interesting, and the way that he seems to find an interesting angle that commands our attention, as he has done in this case with the failure of the judge to fully analyze really all of the failures in his negligence determination in deciding whether or not this was an avoidable situation caused by the operator's unwarrantable failure or not. I also have to commend Commissioner Cohen on the astute observation concerning the production records and the use of batteries or the charging of batteries or lack thereof on the scoops. That's something that didn't occur to me. And I was saying when I was in the Air Force, if it isn't recorded, it didn't happen. And if it isn't measured, it doesn't get done. And it's appropriate there where there's a high degree of safety consciousness and attention to duty required. And I believe the Mine Act is a similar environment. The mine environment is a similar environment to actually being in a military setting, because the actions or omissions of people can have devastating consequences. When you look at this situation, in this case in particular, it was difficult to not think about Aracoma in particular, in light of the potential catastrophe arising from a mine fire, not merely from the typical hazards we associate with fire, smoke inhalation, heat, flame, but the chaos that it injects in the mine environment, the way that it creates an environment that's not conducive to carrying out the regular processes that we assume will be carried out. And that's why the Mine Act imposes a regime that generally requires redundant safety features and you know, cascading opportunities to intercept and eliminate the possibility of error. You can probably get away with, there's enough of a cushion to get away with one mistake or one error in judgment if it's a minor one. But the problem is that when you're in the mine environment, you don't really know if you've used up that allotment yet. And this case is a perfect example for me of that. You know, you had You had really bad bad weather falling upon bad equipment with the battery cables that needed needed attention, bad communication between mine management and other personnel. It really created a situation where if you're going to hang your hat on a simple fire suppression system that requires active application, when you get a curveball and your priorities are reordered as they were in this case, it's vitally important that you follow through and that you make sure that the things that have to be done are done and not that you assume that they're done. In a way, the judge's decision is somewhat understandable because you do get the sense in reviewing the record that this was an operator that was conscious about safety, had a low violation record. Mine management was honest about the situation. Their response to the situation was textbook. But it's important, and I can't stress this enough, to remember that just as in the military context, you can have good people who make an error that is not excusable under the circumstances. And we've held time and again, and I, despite that, would like us to say again in this decision, that the more dangerous the situation, the higher the stakes, the greater degree of care is required. And unwarrantable failure is not in every instance a willful disregard. It's not in every instance a reckless action or omission. Unwarrantable failure goes down to a level that can be characterized as a lack of ordinary care under the circumstances, or greater than ordinary negligence under the circumstances. And the problem that you have is that when the circumstances demand perfect execution, as they did here, a mistake can lead to catastrophe. And it was averted because, yet again, there's another system in place to prevent that catastrophe. But if it hadn't worked, we could have had another situation where you had multiple miners exposed to the chaotic and ruinous catastrophe that a mine fire can bring. And it doesn't get much worse than that. So I agree completely with Commissioner Cohen, with his analysis, with the way he's characterized the actions and omissions here. And I would like the judge to take another look, in particular, at the negligence finding and all of the acts and omissions there. But also, you know, when you're looking at obviousness here, it's not literal obviousness because of the issue with pyrochem maybe in the mine environment being indistinguishable from rock dust. But it's the obviousness that if you know what the operator has to be imputed to have known in this case through the knowledge of the supervisory personnel that pyrochem had not been sprayed, needed to be sprayed, and you were to walk into that environment and take a look around, it hasn't been complied with. And obviously, if you're charging batteries on the ground and you have knowledge of those facts, it's obvious that no, it is not. And it could have been prevented, as the Secretary suggested, by putting a sign there, by recording the condition in the pre-shift examination logs, by making sure that the communication links that are vital to making the mine environment safe are not broken by the changes in circumstances that are going to happen on a day-to-day basis because of things like bad roof and bad weather, things that you can't necessarily control, and things that you may not be able to perfectly anticipate. So I agree with Commissioner Cohen and his analysis on that. I also agree with him on the penalties. I believe the judge has significant latitude, and we should be very hesitant to intrude on that where his findings are supported by substantial evidence and where he does apply the penalty criteria that he's required to apply. In this case, perhaps we would reach a different result on a couple of the penalties, or perhaps not. He's the one who took the evidence. I believe he correctly applied all of the criteria in the sense that he went through the process the way you're supposed to go through the process. Whether any of us sitting in his place would have applied the criteria in a different way or weighted them differently, that's not necessarily our function. I think that we should look at this, you know, pretty much as as whether the judge complied with the process, and if so, did he abuse his discretion in the way he assigned the weights, and I don't believe he did. So I would affirm the penalties for the other three orders, but I would, along with Commissioner Cohen, vacate and remand this case, look at all of the factors, all of the relevant factors that should have been considered, including the extent, the duration of the hazard, the degree of danger in particular. I completely agree that it's somewhat perplexing when you look at what might have happened in this case and what the judge found in his S&S determination to have been a serious, serious danger and a serious risk of a fire in this mine. It needed to be examined in the unwarrantable context, and then again, it needed to be applied in the negligence under that unwarrantability analysis. And finally, I would have the judge obviously reconsider this penalty if he finds that there was, in fact, an unwarrantable failure, or if he finds in his reanalyzing of all of the circumstances that a reassessment of the penalty is otherwise warranted. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Duffy?
Thank you, John, for the DM and for your summary this morning. I joined with my colleagues in complimenting you on laying out some issues that don't necessarily come through in the judge's decision or the pleas, but were very helpful personally, at least to me. I see that our guest has worked way up to the train station, and so I can join with Commissioner Young and his comments with respect to her father. And I think this is the first time that Chairman Jordan is presiding over a commission decisional meeting. When I walked in this morning, it occurred to me that I didn't know where I was supposed to sit. Luckily, Commissioner Cohen had checked out the signs in front and told me where to sit. And it's perfectly comfortable for me. I agree with the recommendations of the decisional memorandum across the board, and I would align myself with the remarks of my colleagues. I do believe the judge neglected to subject the unwarrantable failure allegation to the full breadth of analysis set forth in commission precedents. Over the years, the commission has moved somewhat beyond the circumstances immediately surrounding the discrete violation alleged to be caused by unwarrantable failure to comply. For example, we look at the operator's history of compliance with the standard at issue, and whether or not past enforcement actions would place the operator in a state of heightened awareness of the need to comply. In this case, the evidence shows that there was no such notice because Coal River had a history of careful compliance with the standard. But for this particular incident, the judge found that the operator had taken its compliance responsibility seriously with respect to Section 75340A. On the other hand, the judge did fail to fully analyze the level of seriousness of the violation and its effect on an unwarrantable finding. Thus, while I might, and I stress might, agree with the judge on the unwarrantable failing, given the totality of the circumstances presented here, I find that his analysis is insufficient to make a definitive finding on that issue at this stage. So I would favor remand with the instructions set forth in the DM. As for the penalty assessments for the other violations, I agree with the position set forth in the DM and find that the judge's ultimate assessments were within his discretion and were based upon his determinations on matters of credibility and on the evidence he credited in the record. I would note, however, that with respect to the violation of 75340A, there was another citation issued for a violation of that standard that was not a part of this case, yet it was assessed by the Secretary through a regular assessment process for a total of $286. So although I would ask the judge to revisit his assessment of the penalty for the 340A violation when he revisits the unwarrantable issue, the Secretary's divergent levels of assessment are of interest to me. The bottom line for me is, however, that the judge exercised his discretion appropriately and justified his assessments on the basis of his findings and in keeping with commission precedent. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Duffy. Well, I also join in with the comments of my colleagues, both with appreciation for Commissioner Cohen's presentation today and his general work and analysis on the cases, as has been pointed out. And I also would agree in the recommendation to vacate the judge's determination that the violation of 75 through 40 was not unwarrantable and ask him to reconsider that finding. His analysis, I agree, is not taking appropriate consideration of the factors that the commission has indicated should be taken into account in determining whether a violation is unwarrantable or not. I did also think about the fact that they had been cited for this same standard as my colleague Commissioner Duffy has pointed out, although I sort of wondered about that factor in the course of considering the comments that have been made in the case and the judge's finding of the fact that, you know, they had their low history of violations, and here they had been cited for this very same violation. And, you know, what that means. Also, I wondered about the fact that I can understand that the violation to a certain extent resulted from a situation that arose and things had to be carried out unexpectedly due to the bad roof that was in existence where the prior battery station was located, and so they had to move the battery station out from under the bad roof. And I understood normally they would have applied the PyroChem and got the new station set up before they conducted the move, but here they were sort of an urgency because of the bad roof. However, I do kind of find myself wondering, and the PyroChem bag was frozen, so they have explained that they were not able to apply it right away as they normally would have. But I believe that the record indicates they did take the bag of PyroChem underground and, you know, getting it to thaw out. And I do sort of wonder about, wasn't the bag sitting somewhere around to be noticed by somebody that it was, you know, still in the bag? And I don't know how, you know, for certain how clear the record is on that. There's some reference to that it was over there against the stopping line, but it seems to me in the course of charging batteries and then also in the course of conducting the pre-shift, which they were cited for an inadequate pre-shift, and the electrical examination, that wouldn't that bag of PyroChem sitting there have tipped people off that it still needed to be applied, regardless of the fact that the condition is not so obvious once you put the rock dust around. In terms of the other violation that was cited for the same standard, there is a deviation in the penalty that they assessed under the regular formula, but it does occur to me that here I think there were some other factors that MSHA had noted too, of the cable with this particular battery station stuff that there were problems with, so that may have factored into it. But in sum, I agree that I would vacate the judge's lack of unwarrantable finding, remand for reconsideration in light of the comments that were made today and what will be made in our written decision. And I also agree with my colleagues that I would affirm the judge's assessment of the penalties on the other three violations. I agree with their comments that, you know, perhaps if it would, you know, if it were just up to us, we might have come up with a different penalty amount. But we do consider the abuse of discretion standard. That is a fairly deferential standard. And I believe the judge did consider the factors. He did attribute the weight that in his discretion he thought should be attributed to them. And I think the resulting penalties should be affirmed. So, with that, are there any other questions, comments?
I want to take this opportunity to join with Commissioner Duffy on the remand, looking at the other 75.340A violation.
Oh, okay.
I was looking at it for the purpose of the penalty.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I meant. Just for purpose of penalty.
I think it'd be appropriate to consider that, but it might be difficult to really fully consider. I mean, you've already noted, Commissioner Cohen, the context with the Sago and Aracoma disasters, and I think it's fair to say, you know, things change. But I do think it'd be appropriate to look at that.
Okay. John, are there any questions from you? Do you have what you need to begin drafting? Okay. All right, with that, we will adjourn.
Quick, before they change their mind.